You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
This is Sam Ben Ruby from The Grape Nation. We had an opportunity to go down to the Naples Winter Wine Festival and talk to a bunch of different winemakers. This interview is with Laura Catena from Bodega Catena Zapata Winery in Mendoza, Argentina. Welcome to the Grape Nation on the Heritage Radio Network, your weekly wine journey. We are at the Naples Winter Wine Festival, benefiting the Naples Children and Education Foundation. Our guest is Laura Catena, an old friend, managing director of Bodega Catena Zapata in Mendoza, Argentina. Laura wears many hats in her busy life. Dr. Laura Catena is an emergency room physician, a fourth-generation vintner, founder of the Catena Wine Institute, author, and mom. Laura splits her time between the family winery in Argentina, her own winery, Luca, and practicing medicine in San Francisco. Welcome back to the Grape Nation, Laura.
Thank you, Sam.
And as a side note, I have to say this. Laura was our first ever guest on the Grape Nation way back in 2016. So, and we've seen each other since then, but it's great to have you back, and it's great to have you under these circumstances. We're at the Naples Winter Wine Festival, which is a great charity and fundraiser. So, what are you doing here?
Well, I'm doing a really fun event with Doug Schaefer from Schaefer Winery in California.
Pretty good wine.
Yes.
Hillside Select.
Exactly. So I'm looking forward to see how our wines match up to his. It's always a little scary when you're up with somebody.
So let's talk about that for a second. One of the events at the Naples Wine Festival is the Friday night before the auction. The people that attend are invited to homes and other residences along with a winemaker, a chef, and sommeliers. So people will be congregating. Is it at someone's home?
It's actually at the Botanical Garden.
It's at the Botanical Garden.
Two couples from Naples are hosting
it. And you and Doug Schaefer from Schaefer will be there. Who is your chef?
His name is Eric.
Eric, that's okay. Do you know the restaurant?
From Washington, D.C.
I didn't mean to put you on the spot. So you guys will be pouring out all kinds of wines, current vintages and
some current and some older vintages.
So that's the setup to your point that you're going to be pouring all kinds of Catena wines against a noble Napa wine.
Yes.
And you're very curious to see. Yeah. I'm sure that you curated the right wines.
Yeah, no, we thought a lot about them. But you know what I was particularly pleased about? That I met with Joan Clifford, who is one of the couples that are hosting, and she said, well, you know, we asked Doug Schaefer what you were like, and he said, she's fantastic. It's going to be great. And, you know, that's quite the thumbs up, you know, from Doug Schaefer. So I think I was also pleased to see that he and his wife, Annette, were going to be part of the event.
And not every dinner is multiple winemakers.
Right.
So if you're attending that one, that's a pretty good shot. I want to talk to you about a bunch of things. Typically, do you head back to Argentina for harvest in the next month or two?
Yes, so harvest is actually starting towards the end of January. So it's starting
right now.
Mostly for the sparkling. We do make some sparkling wine that is mostly sold in Argentina, not exported.
What's the grape?
So it's mostly Chardonnay and Pinot Noir for sparkling.
So it's like a blanc?
Yeah, it's a blanc de blanc or you know, also with a little bit of of Pinot Noir. And actually, Argentinians drink so much sparkling that all the sparkling made in Argentina is consumed locally.
It is. Yeah. And the quality is, Catena is making, it's got to be good, but everyone else is.
We don't make a lot of it, but we could make a lot more and sell it. We just don't have the space and the grapes, but the quality is quite good because of the high altitude,
right.
Cool climate.
I want to talk to you about that too.
I don't think it's as good as this Krug I'm having right
now. Well, listen, I'm kicking off the show this week with Olivier Krug. So, you know.
I wouldn't pretend to be as good as Krug.
Yeah, but you're not making champagne. You're making a terrific sparkling wine. So you are, in fact, heading back to work?
Yes, I'm heading back in February.
That's your time. Yeah. You have delegated times. February is time to be...
always go because it's the beginning of harvest. It's where we set out all the parcels that we're going to harvest separately. We start kind of looking at the quality of the vintage and understanding it. And then usually I go again either in March or April. Most of the harvesting happens between March and April. And I like to be there to decide, you know, what is the style of this vintage? What do we want the grapes to taste like? And this is one of the things I love about wine, is that no vintage is the same. And I actually get asked this question a lot. Does Argentina have vintage variability? We have a lot of vintage variability because we're near the Andes. So we don't have a lot of bad vintages, but the grapes taste very differently because sometimes we harvest earlier, later. And to me, that's what's fun about wine, that every year the wine is going to taste a little bit different.
It's a different... challenge,
yeah,
a different
challenge. I mean, we've had two very cold vintages with really small harvests.
The past couple of vintages?
Yeah, so, you know, that means that our wines are very mineral, they're low in alcohol, and some people prefer the warmer vintages. But you know what? Then just wait a year longer or drink an older vintage. But that's what's fun.
So the past few vintages have been challenging.
The past two, actually, interestingly, 2 years, the 16 was very cold and small. So it's kind of a double whammy. You know, we had not a lot of grapes and, you know, very cool climate flavors. The 17 was low in volume, but I've declared it the best vintage in
great
the last
quality.
25 years. Yeah, great quality. 17.
Those will be special
wines. Probably 17 will be the best vintage.
So last
vintage.
September's... Yeah. Harvest.
Well, last February, remember?
It's last February, that's right.
Yeah, February, yeah.
Which I wanted to ask you, so February of 17 is when you harvested,
February, March, April, yeah.
The vintage year is 17, right?
Right.
I just wanted to make sure of that.
But we often call it the 16-17 harvest, even if we harvested in 17. But the year, the actual harvest...
Is that just because the way... It falls in Argentina compared to France and
Napa. Well, in
Napa.
France, you know, it's 6 months later. But we often use the 2 years. But if you read about it in a decanter magazine, it'll say 17.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. Catena are high altitude wines, right? I mean, you alluded to that. I think you've been studying fairly thoroughly high altitude wines. What are the characteristics, you know, what are the qualities, I mean, of a high-altitude wine? What are you going to get with a Catena high-altitude wine? Because that was one of the things your dad really decided was to, you know, move up and grow. Yeah. What's the difference between, is it a more intense berry?
Yeah. Well, first of all, you know, this is very hard for people to understand, that we actually have cool climate, because most people think South America, they're thinking of the beach.
But you're up in the Andes.
But once you go to the Andes, you have this high altitude between 3,000 and 5,000 feet elevation. And there's two important things, actually three, that happen in altitude. The first one is just simply that it gets colder. You know, and you go skiing, you go up, it gets colder, right? So you get this cooler climate, and you get climate, you know, between Bordeaux and Burgundy in terms of temperature. Actually a little cooler than most parts of Napa. Some, you know, probably some of it is closer to Carneros. But the one thing we have is we always have sun. So, for example, Carneros, why is Carneros cooler in Napa? It's because it has a lot of fog.
Right.
We don't have a lot of fog. So mostly what we have is cooler climate with a lot of sunlight. And when my dad decided to plant Malbec, which is a Bordeaux variety, in a climate as cold as Burgundy, people said, you're crazy. In fact, his own viticulturist almost refused to plant there. But my dad was looking for elegant wines with not too high alcohols, wines that could age with good structure. And, you know, he said, okay, if it's colder, but we have all this sunlight. And he was right. You know, and I think he says he was just lucky because, you know, in life you take a lot of gambles.
He's a pretty smart guy.
He claims
and
that.
And the apple doesn't fall far from the tree.
Well, you know, if you ask my dad when he was younger what was more important, you know, luck or hard work, he would have said hard work. Now you ask him, he says luck.
Yeah, well, I guess when you did what he did and you've been around, you could decide, you know, what it is.
Yeah.
So he accomplished what he wanted to, these elegant wines with the altitude and the sun and the cooler weather.
And the third thing that I was going to tell you is that also these soils were formed by glaciers. So when the glaciers recede and the rivers, they leave the heavier stuff higher up and the lighter stuff further down. So you have more stony limestone soils further up. And then
there's
further
down, diversity
you have,
as you move around.
And then
to
as
the
you
soil.
Go down, you get more clays, which are lighter. So actually these stony soils that are from the glaciers receding have a lot of limestone and are extremely well drained. So in these high altitude areas, you cannot get high yields. It's impossible. And so you have these naturally low yields, which definitely help in making more profound wines.
Right. But you blend the different...
Well, in some cases, we blend different altitudes just to get, you know, the acidity, the florals, the ripeness. In some other cases, we make single parcel wines. And we believe...
Tell me a couple of the single parcel.
Yeah, so parcels are Adriana. We have five single parcel wines. Right. We have the White Stones and the White Bones, two very different Chardonnays.
Chardonnay.
And then we have three reds, the River Stones, the Fortuna Terrae, which means luck of the earth, and the Mundus Vasilus Terrae, which, you know, I studied Latin, so I've chosen these crazily hard-to-remember names, but it means elegant microbes of the earth. Because
you have an obsession with microbes.
Yes. And also
why?
Because who owns the Adriana Vineyard, Sam? I'm putting you on the spot. Who owns it? The Catena family or the microbes and the plants who live there? Who owns it?
I'm going to go with my gut.
Yeah.
Which is Mike.
Yes, the microbes. The microbes.
The microbiome.
I mean, the thing is, we go and we take these grapes, but the true inhabitants of that place, the ones that make it possible for us to make great wine, there are the microbes. It's their home.
When was this realization? Because you're right, and I know you studied it, and isn't that one of the drives of the Catena Wine Institute?
Yes. So we are actually doing great deal of research on the microbes in the soil, because my theory is that if we want to preserve these flavors, if we want to preserve, you know, this historic wine that we're making at Adriana that is one of a kind in the world, we need to understand the microbes, measure them, find out who they are, and make sure that they never die away. And so that's why we practice organic viticulture. And it's also because we're studying them because we say, what if climate change happens and they start dying out? We need to find out what's going on with them because maybe there's something we can do to help them. Because I'm convinced that the flavor of those wines comes from this symbiosis between the microbes and the vines. And it's well known that the vines could not survive without the microbes. Humans, you and me, okay, DNA. What you, Sam Ben Ruby, right here
this
in front
like
of me.
This is like a doctor asking me like a medical question. How am I going to do here?
You're going to answer correctly. Okay. Is there more Sam Ben Ruby DNA in you right now or more microbial DNA? I'm hinting at the answer.
I know the answer to this. I know there's this finite number or calculation to DNA, and there's trillions of microbes in your biome
so
or whatever.
So you, Sam Ben Ruby, you are more microbial DNA than human DNA. And it's the same with vines and soils. And the interesting thing is that actually... The soil microbiome is being studied at the same time as the human microbiome. And in fact, the leader in soil microbiome for vines just left us to go study human microbiome, which
really?
I was quite upset at, although I can see how human microbiome would be important.
Yeah.
But he's this guy at UC Davis, Dr. Bokulich, who was the world expert on this, and he's just gone off to work for biotech. I guess there's more money in that or something.
Well, you know, it's another interesting challenge for him.
Yeah.
But it's kudos to you for, you know, looking towards sustainability, consistency, realizing it's more than just, you know, the soil and a bunch of grapes.
Yeah.
And I know you're very much committed to that. I want to ask you a couple more things before I before the interview, I saw you and you told me about this book.
Yes.
That you have in front of you. And I wanted you to tell me about it because you wrote a book, what was it, about 4 or 5 years ago?
Yeah. It was actually published in late 2010. So that's...
It's almost seven, eight years.
Yeah.
I remember when it came out.
The Vino Argentino.
That's right.
About Argentinian wines, which is still on Amazon. You can still find
it.
Third edition. We're already on the third edition.
It's still a good guide to Argentina and wines and food and everything.
Yeah.
But this book...
Okay, so this book is called Oro en los Viñedos, which means gold in the vineyards. And what I realize is that people want to know, okay, so what's the best wine of Italy? What's the greatest wine here or there? The same way as when you go to Paris, you ask your friend,
where should I go?
Yeah, what's the best restaurant? What's the best museum? Same with Buenos Aires. I get asked all the time, where should I go? So I wanted to pick some properties that I think have just done a great job with, putting themselves out there. And often it's a combination of the taste of the wine, which has to be extraordinary, the ageability, but also how this family got there. And I think that...
So it's the wine and the story.
The wine and the story. And, you might find 3 or 4 wines that are all really great, but one of them is better known. Why? And so I found that most wine books basically tell the story of the soil and the parcels and all this very technical stuff. But they don't tell you the really juicy stories of, the family. For example, Joséphine Diquem from Château Diquem. Did you know that actually she and her husband were... Her husband was given the Château Diquem by the king for his military work. He died a few months after their marriage because he fell off a horse. She led Château Diquem into fame, but nobody ever talks about her. And she was actually jailed during the French Revolution. And 2 other chateau owners, Margaux and Lafitte, were guillotined. But they somehow spared her. Maybe she was very charming, who knows? And she came to be the one who sold the wines of Château Diquem to Jefferson, who then took them into California made history. So, there's all these characters.
One of the unheralded women in wine.
Yeah, and in fact, in my book, I made a point to celebrate both men and women, because often you hear about the men, but not about the women. So there's heroes and sheroes in my book. But so I've picked one property per region.
So this is through your experience, view, research. This is Laura Catena telling you, who is very worthy of being in the business and growing up and knowing every aspect. Here are some interesting things for you to look at, because you always ask.
Well, and the thing is, people could ask me, why you and not a master sommelier? Maybe you're biased because you're from Argentina. But you know what? I'm from a family that makes wine. I understand...
There's not a credibility issue here. You don't even have to answer.
Exactly. But
screw them if they don't want to hear your stuff.
I had so much fun. And then at the end of each chapter, I actually do give some of the technical information. So, for example, I explain how does noble rot happen in Sauternes. And it has to do with actually bacteria and fungi that create this...
Botrycized.
Yeah, there's this delicious elixir.
Right.
And most people don't know the science, but it's all explained through illustrations. That's the other thing. It's an illustrated book. Look, it's all
beautiful
illustrations.
So is this book available?
Well, it's available in Spanish.
It's only in Spanish right now.
So your son Ben could read it.
He could interpret for us. When are you going to go English?
English, we're working on it. We're working to find a good publisher,
I'm
in the process.
I think it's a great concept.
I hope so.
I really do.
Yeah.
And because you're so visible and you're an ambassador for Argentina, for your family, for the brand, for wine, for women, like I said, I don't think there's a credibility issue. I'd be very curious to see that. I'll use some translation tool. You had mentioned women, Dickie. We'll wrap up soon. And you're the person to ask this to. Have women found their fair place in the wine world yet? I mean, are we there? I have a lot of women sommeliers and winemakers, and there's different answers.
You know what's really interesting is I look at a lot of these traditional wine families, and what's happening is that some families only have daughters.
Antinori.
And so you could ask him that question when you interview him later. But it probably, if that family had had a son, they might have chosen the son.
He sort of admitted that.
Yeah.
And he looks back and says that's the wrong thing. That thwarted his succession plan in his mind.
Yeah.
And he realized his daughters were interested and came back to it. Yeah. So there was a different perception, but that there's still...
But you know what's interesting?
He rallied and did the right thing.
But you know, the interesting thing is that, yes, women have had a slightly different path, but maybe the fact that some women had to work harder and have had to earn it, that might have prepared them better. You know, I always think that if let's say you inherit something, you don't have to work for it, you're not even going to value it.
I agree, but it shouldn't be that way.
No, it shouldn't, absolutely. But you get
the benefits of the hustle.
But that's why I think that a lot of the women who are in wine today are particularly incredible because they've had to fight a little bit for it. But it shouldn't be that way. And one of the things that I feel very strongly about is that in a lot of wineries, in a lot of businesses, in a lot of... a lot of employers around the world pay women less than men for the same job. This is well documented, and the new generations are not allowing that and are fighting for it. And there's actually data that shows that millennial women are just as good as men are about fighting for salaries. That's not always the case for my generation or the older generation, and that's something that I feel very strongly about. And you know, that's something that has to happen.
So we're still moving. We're not there yet.
We're still, but in terms of, I think that winemaking is very well suited to women because,
a
lot of great women in wine. It sort of bridges science and art, which is something that women are great at. And so I think it's as time
getting
goes
better.
By.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. All right, I'm going to let you go soon, but I have to ask you one more question that's sort of near and dear to both of us. Tell me how you see in the industry and in your business how social media has had an effect on how we consume wine, how we look at it, how you use it. You know, because think 5, 7, 8, 10 years ago, all the discovery on Instagram and Twitter and all didn't exist. What does it mean?
Well, I think that it's really democratizing wine because, you had Olivier Krug on before. And if you send a post to Olivier Krug, he actually answers you. And, I would often meet people at tastings, love them, have a great conversation, and then I'd never see them again. Now they can have a conversation with me and stay in touch through social media. And it's pretty quick, people say, I have to spend so much time on social media. It's quick. People don't want to have a long conversation. You want to just send a few likes, make a little comment. And, with this book that I just released in Argentina, I had so many beautiful comments. This one guy said, I'm on my third reading of the book because it's so much fun. That really made my day. And actually, one thing I would say to people who do social media is, some people think, she's there in her winery. She's the managing director. She doesn't care what I say. When that man sent me that message saying he was reading my book for the third time, he totally made my day. I do care.
That's what you do it for.
Yes. And so to get messages from people saying, I had this vintage and it was the best wine I ever had, that means so much to me. And it gives me the passion to keep on trying to make a better wine every day. So to me, it's been very invigorating. Also, I have people who sell my wine in China, in Holland. And, I see them at some wine show once every 2 years. Now they can send me a message and I can be in touch with people who drink my wine. So I love social media. And a lot of people complain that the kids are always on the phone. You can control it. I don't always answer all the messages right away. And hopefully, I'm excusing myself now. Everybody, if you send me a message, I will eventually answer it. I promise. And if I don't, it's not because I didn't like it. But I think it's wonderful.
You'll get to it.
Yeah.
I think you brought up good points. Democratization.
Yeah.
I think there's more than just a few voices. Everybody has a voice. I think you more than once talked about communication. It's an immediate form of communication from the guy who read the book. Yeah. I think discovery. I think you look at, you see Olivier Krug or Laura Catanez and you see them drinking their wines, other wines, restaurants. And I just think it's a great platform to really communicate a lot of different things in a lot of ways, including promoting your business, which you didn't say. That's there,
well,
but
the bottom line is that I don't know how much it helps me sell wine, but does it give me more passion and joy.
So that alone is a win.
Yes.
If, you know, it creates perception with people, accessibility, yeah. that's a win, you know. So there's a lot to it. And I know that you're a big user of that. All right, Laura, I'm going to let you go because I know you have a busy night. I want to thank Laura Catena for coming back. And I reminded you, or I'll remind you, that Laura was our first guest ever. And we will see her throughout the Naples Winter Wine Festival and hopefully in New York.
Yeah,
so
absolutely.
Good luck with Harvest. I will see you soon. And thank you for coming on The Grape Nation.
And just for my Instagram handle, it's Laura Catena MD.
I forgot to ask you.
Yeah, no, that's okay.
So LauraCatenaMD.
The MD. And then on Twitter, it's just Laura Catena.
And Catena Wines?
Yes, it's actually Twitter, Catena Malbec, and Instagram, Catena Wines.
Okay.
Yeah.
And I think if you hit Catena in Google or whatever, you'll see Twitter and Instagram and all that. Yeah. And go out and try and drink all of Laura's wines. They're terrific. Thanks, Laura.
Thank you, Sam.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Ever wonder what kind of podcast Julia Child would have made? Probably would have been one where she introduced you to all of her latest discoveries and favorite people. And that's exactly the tradition we're following on Inside Julia's Kitchen, the podcast of the Julia Child Foundation for Gastronomy and the Culinary Arts. Join me, Todd Shulkin, your host, and the Foundation's Executive Director, as I bring you inside the Foundation's world to meet the bright lights of today's food universe, just as Julia used to do from her own famous kitchen. New episodes air on Heritage Radio Network Wednesdays at noon Eastern. Listen in.